there are a lot of parents that love their children, but they don't really enjoy necessarily being around them. It doesn't matter how many mistakes you make with your children if they know that you love them. There'll be opportunities to find those connections, and I think the key is to find what they enjoy doing. You're here by your choice. Everything about you is because you've chosen to do it. You've chosen the relationships you have. The problems that come with that are because you made that choice.
Welcome to the Rad Dad Podcast. This is episode 27. I have a good family friend, Paul Whiting, here on the podcast. Just to get started, Paul, tell me a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, and a few highlights.
I grew up just across the street, Mapleton. Highlights, grew up on the farm. Dad was a teacher, school teacher, and a farmer, kind of like your situation,
yeah,
right there in Mapleton.
Yeah. So the Whiting name is pretty well known in Mapleton, right? Did your family, they just owned a bunch of farmland and farmed Mapleton? Are we talking crops or animals?
Yeah, well, my great-great-grandfather lived there. Actually, he lived up Hobble Creek Canyon, and his son, Albert Milton Whiting, lived in Mapleton, and he's well known for in Mapleton history, in our little family history, in that his daughter was the first one to die in Mapleton. She was just seven. First white person to die in Mapleton.
So we're talking like
long time ago.
Settled Mapleton.
Yeah.
The Whitings.
Yeah. Okay. And he had 16 children, my grandfather, and a lot of them stayed there. A lot of them went to Idaho, and they're all farmers.
You grew up learning hard work on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did.
Nowadays, we've talked about this on the podcast. You know, kids don't have the same opportunity to learn hard work. They can still learn hard work, and a lot of times it's done through athletics and other things, but farming is the original hard work.
It is. My dad used to say that he was responsible for most of the Mapleton kids that went to college, because after they came and worked with him on the farm, they didn't want to do that for a living.
Yeah. So I guess, are we talking crops or animals?
Sheep. We raised sheep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We raised, I think it was about 1,000 head of sheep, 500 to 1,000. I don't even remember. I was just a little guy. But on Sunday mornings, didn't matter, Monday morning, whatever morning it was, when it snowed or rained, you had to go bed sheep. And my brothers were always a little troubled with me, because by the time when I turned 12, we got out of the sheep business.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always bring that up to me.
Yeah. Aaron never had to do.
Well, I used to go over there a few times. I remember getting up and going over, a little guy, but hauling hay and hoeing beets, picking cherries, and all those things that I look back with tremendously fond memories, were things that I hated to do.
Interesting.
Cleaning ditch. Although, when I say I hated to do them, once we'd get started, my dad could make a race or a competition out of almost anything we were doing. After a long day of hauling hay, he'd say, "All right, boys, we've got the church welfare to go to and haul hay. We're going to go teach those city slickers how to haul hay." I thought, oh boy, that sounds like fun. After all day of hauling hay, we went down to Springville there where Harvard's is, you know.
Yeah, to haul more hay.
To haul more hay. But he was a good motivator. He'd come home, we'd go home for lunch, and he'd brag on us to my mom and tell her what great workers we were. Whether we did or not, you know, but he made us feel like that was that we were important and that we were doing important work. And you know, as little guys, we really weren't doing much. We used to drive tractor and knocked my grandpa off the back of the wagon, the hay wagon, once and half the load. And my grandfather, he was a pretty fantastic man. He was he is a bishop and a patriarch and all the qualities that go with those kind of people, he definitely possessed. But I stopped the tractor and went back and saw him on the ground and all the hay on the ground. And he got up and he said, "Well, that's a fine how do you do?" Didn't cuss at me, didn't get mad. But for raising sheep, you know, I never heard him swear. And anybody that's worked around animals can know that's not an easy thing.
No, it's not. Right?
Yeah, pretty lucky.
What other qualities did you recognize growing up? What other qualities did you recognize in your father that you maybe said, that's how I want to be?
Well, it almost makes me want to cry. Because I have a tremendous love for my dad. Well, I have a friend. I had a pretty close friend in college who I remember him telling me that he knew that his parents loved him, but they didn't like him.
He told you that?
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
And I thought, well, I'd never ever heard anybody say anything like that. They love you, but they didn't like you. But I think that there are a lot of parents that love their children, but they don't really enjoy necessarily being around them or doing things with them. And that's one thing that my dad loved, that I knew. He loved me and he liked me. My dad liked me a lot. He played college basketball, some semi-pro basketball, played for the University of Utah. And he, you know, basketball was something that he loved the sport, and he loved having me grow in that sport, just like your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine taking away your I'm going to say karate. It was taekwondo. What was it? It was taekwondo.
Taekwondo and wrestling.
Yeah.
The two.
Oh, and wrestling, yeah. Take all of that experience away from Joe Kelly and you, and you have an empty life.
I don't know that I'd recognize me.
You wouldn't.
Without those two.
You wouldn't. And that's it's the same with my dad. My mom loved tennis. She found that commonality with me. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, I never saw her play or never knew that she played, but she loved getting me involved in tennis when I was 7 years old. So that those qualities, I mean, she signed me up for every tennis tournament she could sign me up for, took me to every tournament I could possibly get into in Salt Lake, and sent me off to Colorado with some friends when I was 12 to play. And she was behind that, but my dad was always behind my basketball. And that's what we did. I mean, when my dad came home from work, from teaching school, he'd open the door and holler and make sure everybody was happy and let everybody know he was home. And we'd immediately turn the TV off and go out and play basketball with him. Because we knew he'd go give us the time on the court.
Yeah.
So to me, that's, you know, back to my friend, I don't think my friend had that. He had what kids should know, that their parents love them.
Yeah.
But not that they really enjoyed spending time with them. You know, fishing, hunting, and just working with him all the time. We were just with my parents all the time. So I've tried to do that with my boys.
So I love this point you're making. And I'm at the stage, I have a 3-year-old boy. I'm at the stage where we are starting to spend time together.
Yeah.
Like last year, you know, he reeled in his first fish and he's getting into bikes, and I have that opportunity to now spend time with him. What is your advice to young fathers that are maybe intimidated or just don't know how to go about spending time with their kids?
That's a tough one, because you're going to do it because your dad did it with you, and I did it because my dad did it with me. If your parents didn't do it with you, you might not see, you might not capture the vision of it. But I think the idea of making your children your very best friends, your very best little friends, they'll grow up to be your very best big friends.
Interesting.
You know? And I can't say, you know, as far as giving advice, I told Keisha, my 18-year-old, she's 19 now, that I was coming to do a podcast mm-hmm. on fathers. And she just got this big smirk on her face. And I said, you don't need to say anything, because this, it's not about being a good father. It's just about lessons learned, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same when I told Jerry that I was coming, Jerry and Kemri, my son and daughter-in-law, they got this smile on their face about, oh, you're going to go talk about how to be a father. I don't claim to be a great parent. But advice-wise, I could throw out some advice I learned from my brother Mark. One time he told me, I don't know why we were on the conversation, but... he said, in regards to his own children, that he said, it doesn't matter how many mistakes you make with your children if they know that you love them. And I thought that was pretty important, because we're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And as far as giving advice about what, in relation to the question you just asked, how do you, how do you make time, find that, commonality. I didn't do a very good job as a stepdad. So I have 11 children. My first four with my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then I inherited five. And then we have two together. So our last two. So a total of 11. And I can't say that with each one of them I found and connected with that commonality. The ones who loved sports, that was easy. You know, I've got Tennyson. That's Tennyson right there. He's on the ATP tennis tour. And, you know, it was 5 o'clock in the morning. We're down working out. And after school, we're working out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's just like with your
yeah.
dad.
Yeah.
I saw you in the... I want to say the dojo. I don't know what you called it.
Yeah.
Did you call it the dojo?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, with some of the other ones, I mean, I have one son who we went fishing, and he didn't want to clean the fish. You know, it was like gross, right? And that's very different than... You know, my other son, who's happy to dig away at it and show me where the guts are and the heart and the liver, whatever, right? Different, different personalities. And some personalities you may find with 11 kids, and with your two kids, Lila, it's time to see, but
mm-hmm.
you might not find connections right away, but... There'll be opportunities to find those connections. And I think the key is to find what they enjoy doing, not so much as what... That's the mistake that I made as I look back, because with my last two children, not so much with my tennis son, but with Keisha,
mm-hmm.
Dance, you know, I'm not interested in dance, or am I? So when I start going to her dance competitions with her, and I start learning some of the fun, competitive things of dance, I really got to love it. And she got to dance in the international Guatemalan national theater and do some big things. Went to a big dance competition in Chicago, and we traveled with her, and we, you know, we found that, that those interests were our interests too, my wife and I, you know?
Yeah. Anyone that knows the Kellys knows that we're wrestlers, right? So when I had a son, you know, people come up to me and they're like, what are you going to do if he doesn't wrestle? Mm-hmm. I've had quite a few people ask me that. And my answer is, whatever he does, I'm going to love it. I'm going to support him. You know, obviously I want him to wrestle, just like you love to have kids that play tennis. Yeah. You mm-hmm. share the same interests, but in the end, I think you're right. Whatever they're interested in, you learn about it and you become interested. That's where mm-hmm. the connection's created. But I'm sure with 11 kids, you have to kind of be a Renaissance man, because those are 11 individual people with 11, you know, different personalities and yeah. interests. And it seems like a lot of work.
Yeah. Do you work at home?
I do.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a big advantage.
Yeah.
Over the folks who have to go to
yeah.
to 40 weeks away from the home. See, for me, it was easy. I worked at home. Of course, it has its challenges too, because sometimes yeah. when you work at home, you're not doing 40 hours, you're doing 80 hours, and yeah. your wife knocks on the door and of your office and says, oh, now are you going to tell me you're doing National Guard work? What's this, 25 cents an hour? When I was the commander of a National Guard unit, right? But, you know, but my kids always knew they could knock on the door. They didn't have to knock on the door. They just came in my office.
Yeah.
And they knew that whatever I was doing, unless I was on a call and, you know, I could hang up, but they're going to wait for me. I'm not going to sit and keep talking, right?
Yeah.
And I would go do what they needed to do.
So you were working at home before it was cool to work at home.
It's always been cool to work at home. Yeah, I've, with the exception of the Army duty that I did, and, you know, most of it was National Guard and, you know, weekend stuff, but, you know, a couple of tours of, you know, active duty. Beyond that, you know, I was always home doing real estate and
mm-hmm.
finance.
Gotcha. Well, I've really enjoyed it. And Nilsen and I talked a little bit about the advantages of working from home, and man, going back into an office, just thinking about that makes me sick. So I think I'll do whatever I can to stay in my situation. Talk to me about your experience becoming a father. What did you feel? What did you go through? How did you react?
My experience becoming a father. Well, I just left my oldest son's house, Jerry. He was my firstborn up in Logan. My wife was, she knew she was ready to have her baby. And she had a real fear of thinking that she wanted to go into the hospital and be one of those mothers, one of those women that went in and got sent home because she wasn't really having her baby. I don't know why she was so worried about that, but she was. It was a real deal for her and a real issue. And so, you know, when she was ready to have her baby, she's ready to have her baby. And I ran out. I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I ran out to, you know, at Logan, Utah, out to turn the car on. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I turned the car on and I thought, well, I'm going to turn the wipers on to clean off the ice.
Yeah.
And like a bonehead, I pushed the washer fluid. And so the washer fluid went all over and just froze this, I mean, like thick ice all over the windshield. Anyway, I got my wife into the car and spent 10 minutes trying to dig off all the ice off the car. And it was 17 below zero.
Oh, gosh.
You know, January 30th in Logan, Utah. It's about the coldest place on the planet. Birthday. January 30th.
Yep.
Well, there you go. Same as Jerry's.
Yeah.
Good birthday. Good birthday. So we drove in and we got to the hospital and she had the baby within an hour.
Wow.
So she had definitely waited and then had to wait for me the extra 10 minutes to clean off the windshield. But I remember when that little baby was born, that was, that was a miracle. There's nothing like that. I was a little nervous because I had never seen a I'd never even, I mean, not in video or, we didn't have video stuff to look at.
And yeah.
I had never seen a baby being born. And I saw this white convoluted head coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like it was just the brain. And for a moment, my heart just dropped thinking, he doesn't have a skull.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know how they have that white stuff all yeah. over him? And so I just saw these convolutions and I thought, oh my heck. He doesn't have the skull part of his head. But he
you didn't say anything out loud,
though. I didn't say anything out loud, but it made me nervous for a moment there. And anyway, he was born quickly, and I got to carry him down to where they gave him shots. Kind of irritated me. They had to give him shots for STD, sexual transmitted diseases, right? I had to give it in. They gave it to him in his foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, he's still going to have a problem with that. Yeah, because if you don't, then they can go blind. And yeah, so I know why I had to do it. But he was so numb from the experience. He didn't feel a thing. He didn't cry. He didn't, you know, I think that our birth is a pretty overwhelming experience mm-hmm. physically, probably emotionally and spiritually too, but. And just holding the little baby, you know, little blonde curly hair, kind of like color of your hair. And man, that was great.
Was there ever a point in those first weeks or months where self-doubt set in?
Self-doubt?
Yeah, like, can I be a father? Well, can I raise this child?
No, before.
Before.
Yeah, before for sure.
During the pregnancy or?
Well, I just remember getting married. I was 21 when I got married and I thought, wow, I am way too young to be married. I probably was. But to be a parent was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
How am I going to do that?
How old were you when you had your first kid?
22.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's pretty intimidating. I was 28. We waited a little bit.
Yeah.
We were married for quite a few years and then, but
that's even probably
then,
better.
Even then, you know, having a kid, I still feel like, man, I'm not old enough. I'm not an adult yet. I'm not old enough to have another human, you know, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's, I always like to hear stories of, you know, from the dad, because we always hear the story, how the mom, you know, went through all of the whole experience, but we never hear the story of the dad.
Yeah, let's back up on that. Because the first 9 months is pretty miserable.
And first nine months of what?
Of morning sickness.
Mm, the pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And you say that out loud, and your wife hears you, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Because she's the one that's vomiting and throwing up. And,
yes.
And sometimes not happy because she's sick all the time. So I would, you know, that part's miserable for the husband too. You know, I mean, it's not miserable in the same way.
Well, sometimes you just feel helpless.
And hopefully there's no women watching this, because they'd be troubled with it, with me even saying that, because they go through so much. But that, my wife got so sick. And she would be vomiting two or three times. I mean, I remember pulling over to the curb and she'd have to throw up in the curb.
Yeah.
Because she just was so sick. And I think it was just for the first few months, but then after that, it did a little better. But still, it's a miserable experience for them.
Yep.
And, you know, you get to be right there with them in their miserable experience.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit. Was there ever a time where you felt self-doubt just in general throughout fatherhood?
Oh my gosh. Being a stepdad, that's not an easy thing to combine a family. I felt like we had an advantage because we were young enough to have kids together. And when we had Tennyson, everybody became related. And there was a real sense of, well, we're related, I'm related to your dad because you're my brother, right? And now, Keisha, now you're my sister. So I think that made a big difference. I had wonderful stepchildren, like unbelievably good stepchildren. And the amazing, I'm still amazed to this day that I never saw it. They might, you know, if they watch this, they may say I'm full of baloney. But from my perspective and my wife's perspective, because we've talked about it, they never argued with each other across the family. They'd argue with their own siblings, but they never argued with the step-siblings.
Interesting.
Which, as I think about it, had that been going on, that would have been really tough on the marriage relationship, because you want to side immediately with your side of the program, right? My wife used to say, well, you don't love them. You don't love my kids like your kids. And then I'd try to defend myself. Oh, well, I do. And I'm doing this. And then about midway through that, the raising of the kids, one day it just dawned on me, why do you sit there and try and defend that? That's dumb. And when I acknowledge, okay, I don't. But I pray every day to love them like I love my own children. And there are a lot of times that I love your children more than I love my children.
Yeah.
So maybe at this moment, it might not appear to you that the way I'm acting here or I'm doing some special thing over here, but I'm leaving this child out because I leave my children out. And next time it might be this way. From my perspective, I felt like I was trying to always be as generous or kind and as loving to my stepchildren, which I considered my children as much as my other children, because I saw it as a tremendous privilege and stewardship and opportunity. But that's a stressful, tough thing to do, because you know, a mother hovers over her children like a chicken, a hen gathering her little chicks, and if you get in the way of that, then you know, then you got a tough relationship going, and in marriages you got to know and understand that your spouse comes first. I know that I've heard a lot of people that haven't gotten remarried that have told me, well, you know, my kids are, I don't want to get remarried because my kids are the most important. And I've thought to myself, well, you're right. You better stay not married, because when you get married, your spouse better be number one. And that's not an easy thing, because you've only known this guy or this gal a year or two or however long you knew him. I knew my wife 60 days. So 30 days after I got married, I met Sherry, and 60 days later, we got married. Did I say that right?
Divorced.
When I got divorced, 30 days later, I met Sherry, and within 60 days, we got married. So she could have said, well, you know, why would I have allegiance toward you, and how could you possibly be number one in front of my children? But she did that, and I tried to do it too. And I think that's why our relationship actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Statistically, the second marriages are twice the divorce rate as the first. At least something I'd read or heard.
Did you feel a weight being the man and bringing kids from two different families, a new marriage? Did you feel a lot of weight to make it work and to kind of be the glue and make sure everyone's okay?
I don't think so. I never saw myself as the glue. Sherry was the glue, is the glue.
Okay.
So I've never seen myself
so you let as, her do the, her
as thing. Being much glue. Yeah. My wife taught me something one time, though, very important about some of the stress that I had felt about, you know, we wanted to travel back to the Nauvoo temple dedication. Mm. And we had this big old Suburban, and we had another little car, and we had to drive both of them back there to make it work. And I remember getting some gold coins out of the my little safe to pay child support and alimony that month.
I'm 31 years old now. If you could go back to 31-year-old Paul.
You're getting up there because I remember you when you were this big.
I feel that. I feel that way.
Yeah.
If you could go have a 5-minute conversation with 31-year-old Paul, what would you talk about?
I don't think it would have done any good.
Why is that?
Well, because I think I'm a slow learner when it comes to...
You need a little more than 5 minutes.
Well, I don't know that I would listen to myself any more than I'd listen to my mom trying to tell me how to be a good parent. Do you listen to your mom about being a good parent? How to be? Listen to your dad about how you should be a good parent? Do you? Well, you're good. You're a humble kid. I wasn't... I have not been that way. I should be.
So what changed from 31 years old to now where you can now recognize that?
Well, I don't know that I recognize that. I mean, I recognize how I am. I don't know that I'm any different now than then. I don't know, Jace. That's a tough one. I've learned a lot, if that's what you're asking me.
Yeah.
I think that I made a lot of mistakes in how I raised my children, probably even more with how I raised my stepchildren. I've been accused of being too harsh, being controlling, being yelling, getting mad, scaring them, the kids, you know, into doing things, and blamed from my army. You know, I'm an airborne ranger in the army. Comes with the territory. Yeah. Or does it? I don't know. Was Captain Moroni that way? I've wondered.
So, speaking of your military experience, were there things that you learned in training and just through your years of service that helped in your family life?
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
But that comes up as a negative thing.
Really?
Yeah. But this probably the qualities that the children or my wife doesn't see or didn't see so much. There's the military is an incredible educational training, mentoring opportunity that trains you to be a better dad, for sure, to be a better leader, to step up and take responsibility for what you need to be responsible for. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that have happened in my life when at first glance I've thought, well, that was because he did or she did or because that happened or because I got ripped off or and then I would think of my military training and think, are you kidding me? You're in this situation because you chose to be here. You're in Ranger school because you chose to be here. You want to go home? You can go home right now. I remember my Ranger instructor with a hamburger in his mouth. He goes, and he had another one in his sack. And he said, do you want a hamburger? You can have this. And you're eating one meal a day for 60 days. And a hamburger, a McDonald's hamburger, at 2 weeks into the program, one meal a day is looking pretty good.
Yeah.
Here, you can have one. And yet you knew that he was trying to trick you, because if you did, then, you know, we can send you home at any time. You know, you can't eat something outside of what you're supposed to eat, right? So you're here by your choice. Everything about you is because you've chosen to do it. You've chosen the relationships you have. The problems that come with that are because you made that choice. And they are positive consequences or they're negative consequences. And that's it. The military helps you understand that. There's no... You're accountable and you're responsible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all... In the first 5 years of my active duty service, I was in schools for 4 of those years. And then throughout, you know, it's it's a pretty incredible educational opportunity.
So I'm going to flip the question on you now. Was there anything that you learned in fatherhood that helped you in your military life?
Oh, you mean the other way around?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Well, especially as a commander, and you have kids that come in and have done some pretty stupid things. I had a kid that stole a, he climbed over a post office fence to get into those little electric, I think it was an electric car or whatever, mm-hmm. the little cars that they have. He's one of my mechanics. He climbed in with his buddies and knew how to get it started and going and drove through the fence. And just something dumb, but you know, he got court-martialed for it and had to go to jail. In the Army jail, that's not good. I mean, it was a federal offense. U.S. Post Office of all dumb things, yeah. Right? But I remember having some real heart-to-heart talks with him, because I felt like he was my son doing something, you know. He was drunk. He was out partying with his friends, and he didn't have his right brain on for sure.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of experiences that I had in the military where you're counseling people that, you know, young soldiers that, well, even older soldiers. I had a medical doctor that worked for me. that got caught shoplifting with his wife. Well, it was his wife that was shoplifting.
Oh, God.
And he was covering it up because it was his wife, and it was all on tape. And so the military came down with a pretty hard hammer on him. And it was my responsibility as the commander to, you know, inflict whatever consequences, the harshest that I could mete out, right? But they didn't have control over it as much as they wanted. And I've always felt to err on the compassionate side when it comes to those kinds of things.
Even in the military.
Yeah, especially in the military. Especially in the military. At least that was my perspective. I've done enough dumb things in my life where, you know, I really, I'm not looking forward to a just God, right? I want the merciful God to be the one that I'm sitting down with. And I think, you know, with my children, my children have been pretty dang good. They could have rebelled against me. With my stepchildren, not one time did they ever mouth off at me or buck me and disobey me. Is that amazing?
Yeah. It's not how you picture a step family.
Like, no, that,
from what you see in movies.
No, it's a good thing. Because I don't know how I would have responded. I probably wouldn't have responded very well to that. Now my own kids, they could say whatever they didn't, but you know, they knew they could. But yeah.
What has been harder for you, the first 10 years of fatherhood or your last 10 years of fatherhood?
Well, I'm an old dude, so I have a lot more than 10 and 10, right? So how about 20 and 20? 'Cause that would be exact, right? The first 20 are way more difficult than the last 20. That is for dang sure.
It's good to know.
Yeah, at least from my perspective. And being a being a grandparent, you know, just this last weekend we went camping and there were some issues with the grandkids fighting. And my daughter stepped in because she didn't like how I was handling it. And I got in trouble with her. I got in trouble with my grandchild, and I got in trouble with my grandchild's parent, mom, and when with my wife, and I went home. It was just a tough day, and I had two of the boys that had stayed with us overnight came stayed at our house, and one wakes me up at 2 a.m. to let me know that he peed the bed, and I get up, I go down, start moving the covers, and I'm picking them up, and I haul them out, go out to the deck, and I'm thinking, geez, I've had COVID four different times, so I have no smell. I go back, and I step in something, and I'm feeling around, and Jesse says, well, Grandpa, no. I threw up. And I had been digging around in that. So I had him go sleep in the other room. So by 2 in the morning, an hour later, I'd cleaned it all up. But this kind of, this was at the end of already a pretty tough, emotional day, stressful day as yeah. a parent, you know, as a grandparent. This was just Saturday. And I thought, are you kidding me? I have been a parent and grandparent this long, and I'm still a bonehead. And so many things in the way I do things. But I also, back to your question, realized, dang, I remember what it was like to be a dad. It was just like this weekend in the intensity and the challenges and serving everybody and making sure everybody's good. And, yeah. and it was just, it was a nice little reminder of how tough the first 20 years can be.
It's the type of thing where you can't read it in a book. You just have to experience it.
Yeah.
No one can tell you, hey, this is what to expect in fatherhood and this is how to handle it, because it's different and there's so many different things that can happen and ways to react.
Yeah.
So that's really cool.
It's true.
Talk to me about what you have done or ways that you have found to help yourself with mental health.
Mental health? I've never, to be honest with you, ever thought about that. I thrive on accomplishment. So if I have a goal that I'm moving toward, when you say mental health, I don't know what you're referring to. What I hear you saying in that is I can think of depression. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. Have I been depressed?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking me?
Well, that's a negative side of mental health, but there's a positive side too.
Okay.
I'm just, yeah.
Well, I've never had anybody say, how's your mental health today? Because that would.
I think most men haven't.
Because I would take that as a pejorative. Definitely a negative connotation there.
Yeah.
You know, if you're talking about mental health, I mean, the guy's mental, right? I mean, I'm thinking, well, that's a negative thing. But if you're talking positive, well, I feel like I've been pretty lucky in that regard. I had a mother who loved to keep me engaged in everything I could possibly do. I remember one of the presidents of the church saying, you can't give your child too many good things to do. And I think, I don't even know if that was a president of the church, but somebody said it, and my mom sure latched onto that.
Yeah.
Because I always had a lot of things to do. I'm working on my doctorate of business administration, my DBA right now, actually. I just finished my first year. And I'm an old guy. But I'm going to get my, you know, I've still 3 more years and I'll get it done. I got my MBA when I was 50. I think if I'm learning and I'm moving toward a goal, I stay happy and motivated about things.
Well, that's a great answer, and that's a perfect point, because we've talked about this on a few different episodes of the podcast, but my perspective is if someone does not have purpose, that's when the depression sets in, the self-doubt, you know, the negativity. But you said you thrive on goals and achievement. That just tells me you've stayed busy your whole life. And busy is a positive thing. From my perspective, I can relate to that a lot. If I'm not working towards something, I'll go crazy. And if I have 3 things to work towards, even better. You know, it keeps my mind occupied and I have a purpose in the morning. What advice would you give to people that can't seem to get out of the rut, that it's hard to set a goal. It's hard to move forward and take that first step.
I don't know if I'm answering your question, but what first came to mind, I had an aunt that had had a severe fever when she was 3 years old, and it damaged her brain. And so she was, I don't know what her age was. She always told me she was sweet 16. And you're 16. She'd have a birthday. She's 16. And I remember by the time I was 12, I realized she's not 16. She's probably 35, 40 maybe. But she was kind of on my level of a 12-year-old, a 6-year-old, and then sometimes maybe a 15 or 16. She could read and she could reason, but then some of her social skills were pretty, were lower. Mm-hmm. And the point came when my grandparents were too old to continue to take care of her. And so she had to go over to a home in Provo with all these, she'd do that. We'd talk and turn, and somebody would come by and do something, and she'd go, "Don't just ignore him. He's." She knew that she wasn't I use the word retarded, but it was a retardation of, you know, a slowness, mm-hmm. that she knew she wasn't as slow as the people she was living with, and she wasn't. But she would experience depression. And I remember my mom, I was with my mother, and we were visiting with the nurses, and we tried to help with her situation and visit her as much as we could. But she's my favorite aunt of all time. She was a wonderful lady. But I remember in the conversation, the nurses and doctors talking about her, you know, she's on this medication, she's on that medication. I mean, she had pills out the gazoo, mm-hmm. But she's just, you know, she's just not, and it was all about her. She was in the room with us. And I remember my mom asking the doctors a question that stuck with me for a long time. And I think it answers is an answer to, you know, the idea of what advice. She said, well, what is Virginia doing to serve others here? I mean, we've been talking all about her and of this and what she needs and all this, but what's she doing to serve others? She's very capable. She's far more capable than anybody else here.
Yeah.
And they kind of scratched their head and kind of writing down notes thinking, and my aunt knew, because she knew what it meant to serve others. And my mom was able to do it in a way that wasn't offensive to my aunt. And it might have offended the caregivers there a little bit, because it was, you know, it was kind of an off the wall question. But I think, you know, in times when I become selfish, which is, you know, it's pretty often, but when I'm more selfish than not, is when I'm not as happy.
Okay.
Now, what can I do to serve somebody else? And that can lift me.
I like it. Just to wrap up this podcast, I ask the same question to all my guests. And that is, if there's one lesson you could leave your kids when you're no longer here, what is that lesson?
Well, I can see why this is the last question. You can't. What if I don't know the answer to that? One thing that I'd leave them.
Yep.
I don't know. One lesson, huh? That one thing, Curly.
Yep.
All right. Well, as far as what? As far as being a father? Being a mother?
A life lesson.
Just a life lesson. Well, we haven't brought God into the picture in a lot of things. I mean, hopefully he's been in the picture, but we haven't mentioned him specifically, but I would hope that my children and my grandchildren would, when they think about old Grandpa Paul or Grandpa Whiting, that they would want to know a little bit more about Heavenly Father and their purpose in being here in life. It, for me, it's just, it's a really an amazing, thing to think that, there are people who go through this life not believing in God and what He can do for you. And the gospel, the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, that, that's been given to us, been given to you and to me, and we go out and we preach the gospel and try to help others understand what that's about. But, you know, the thing probably on my mission that I remember more than anything else, and I don't know if you know, my wife and I just got called to serve a mission in Hawaii in December. And my daughter's leaving for her mission to Mexico just next month. Meri de Mexico, Keisha. But I remember teaching, or in the discussion, that the whole objective of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to help us become a better father, a better mother, or a better brother, a better sister, a better uncle, a better aunt, a better cousin, a better friend. And I remember saying that for the first time, teaching that for the first time, and it just overwhelmed me with a wonderful spirit to think, oh, that is what it is. That is what the gospel's about. That's why, that's what it's all about. It's all about wanting to be better at, in those stewardships that are lasting and meaningful, that last forever. So I would hope that my kids would get that part. If they don't get or accept any or all of the gospel or the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, or however they view our Heavenly Father, that they would grasp the belief that the teachings that are in the scriptures and the prophets are to help us to become better people, and that they would want that.
Awesome.
That's kind of a long answer for telling you I didn't have an answer, huh?
Yeah, it was well put. Well, thank you for being on, sharing your experiences and stories and thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jace. It's been fun.
Awesome.